Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and I'm joined today with co-host and legal expert Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. It's not often that Justice Alaska ventures away from major functions of the Alaska court system, like how judges are selected, how to find an attorney, how to survive traffic court, or how parole and probation work. But today, we'll be discussing a work of Alaska historical nonfiction relevant to our state's judicial system. It has a fun title, The Biggest Damned Hat. And I'm sure we'll learn the significance of that title as we hear the stories of Alaska's territorial lawyers and judges from the book's author, a writer and lawyer and longtime Alaskan, Pamela Kravis. To get the ball rolling, I'd like to invite Judge Andrews to introduce our guest and get the storytelling about Alaska territorial judges and lawyers started. These are colorful stories, many of which involve hard work, but also drinking and grandstanding. Since Alaska's history is really very short, I suspect listeners will remember some of these names and some of these stories. Join us with your recollections of the roiling and free-spirited early days of Alaska justice. You can communicate with us by calling 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. That's statewide. And some of these stories are from Fairbanks and Ketchikan and Nome. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's get started. Judge Andrews?
Well, this is going to be a fun hour, I think. And both Kathleen and I were saying, what can we talk about in the justice system around Christmas that's not going to be have
Christmas
some
in jail.
Yes, that's not going to have some unhappiness attached to it.
Yeah.
And we were delighted to be able to invite Pam to join us. She has interviewed more than 50 lawyers who began practicing law prior to statehood in 1959. She's written extensively about the early practice of law and given presentations throughout the state. Her articles about the territorial years have appeared in the Alaska Law Review, the Alaska Journal, the Daily News, and other publications. She has worked as a public defender, chief of staff, communications director, reporter, writer, and researcher. She holds a JD from the Catholic University School of Law and an MFA in creative nonfiction from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. So welcome, Pam. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
So this is, and really I do want to echo Kathleen's invitation to have people join us in this conversation. Over the years, I've had the privilege of being at the Territorial Lawyers Dinner, which they have every year. And I can assure you that a group full of lawyers are not microphone shy. So I do want to encourage people who have stories about the early years to join us and add what tidbits they may have that they think will enliven the conversation. So with that, I'm curious, Pam, how it is you came to write this book. There's lots of historical material, but I haven't seen anyone put it together in the way you have. And what motivated you to do that?
Great question. So I came up in 1980. I'd been in law school in D.C., and I came up with my then-boyfriend and now husband, Glenn. And it was supposed to be a lark, you know, like everybody does, the 1-2-year plan. Anyway, he had a job, and I didn't. And I looked on the board in the law library, and it looked like there was an intern opening in the DA's office. So I went downstairs, and I talked to Larry Weeks, who was a DA, and the next week I was in a job. Now, you can imagine if I'm going to law school in Washington, D.C., and I come to Alaska and I get a job just by sitting and talking to somebody, this was like a huge revelation to me. I mean, all of my law school buddies were like going to these big law firms and bragging about working these really long hours and the three-piece suits and blah, blah, blah. And here, you know, people were not wearing three-piece suits, and it was just a really cool place. So I had never really been interested in practicing law. And I went to Larry and I said, well, what could I write about these lawyers here? You know, I'm interested in writing some stories. And he said, well, you know what? Go talk to Russ Arnett. And Russ Arnett was just a few blocks away in his office. And he had been writing these little stories in the Bar Rag about territorial lawyers.
And the Bar Rag is a publication by the Alaska Bar Association for its lawyer members. It's an internal little irreverent, as most of these stories might suggest, something of an irreverent publication for lawyers, a little newspaper.
Exactly.
Yes.
And Russ was the unofficial bar historian, and he would, you know, people would know it. I mean, at that time, we're talking 1980. So he was really writing for his, right, as you were saying, his audience. And I could understand some of the stories, but some I couldn't. And he gave me copies of all of his stories. And I know, which was a real...
Your treasure.
It was an act of generosity. Mm-hmm. So I decided to follow up. And I went to the Anchorage Bar Association that was quite flush because they got money from the copy machine in the lot library.
A slush fund.
A slush fund.
Better than the slot machine.
Yeah. Right.
Pretty close to the same thing when you're talking about lawyers copying things.
Right.
But, and so I had a proposal to interview lawyers who were here before statehood.
So you came up with the idea.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe somebody was wanting the history written and you stumbled in and they said, hey, you can do it. You actually said, why don't we? Based on Russ Arnett's the kind of colorful. And did you say in your book that he left names out?
Yes. He left many names out. He was circumspect, but he was accurate. Uh-huh. And he'd gone to Northwestern Law School. I mean, he was the most wonderful man. Uh-huh. He was just a very nice man. So, And so I followed up and I traveled the state and I interviewed these lawyers who were here before statehood. And I have to say, I have to define oral history just a little bit.
Sure, go ahead.
And then it's like if people were to ask you about the people you work with, and if you like them, you're going to embellish and tell us they're just great and they're wonderful and convince me that they really are. And if you're not too fond of them, you're going to make sure I understand their lesser
faults.
Good, right, all their faults. So that's what oral history is like. And so as the person who's collecting them, you kind of have to talk to lots of people and get an idea, and then you end up landing somewhere. So I don't vouch for the accuracy of the stories, but I do vouch for the fact that I was told them and I attribute everything. So,
well, would it be okay if we got the name out of the way, The Biggest Damned Hat? Because that's not doesn't obviously sound like a legal history book.
No, it doesn't.
So, do you want to start by reading that section on Grigsby?
I can. So, the one thing that everybody talked about, the one person, was George Grigsby. And I'll just read a little bit about George. And I never talked to George Grigsby, to
He was
be
gone
clear.
By the time you came
He was
along.
Gone.
Yeah.
Right.
But everybody else talked about
they
George
had, and I think,
in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is what I write about George Grigsby. George Grigsby never sat on the bench, never wrote any books, and never contributed to a body of legal scholarship. His accomplishments included a quick wit, the ability to tell a good story, and longevity. Arriving in Nome in the summer of 1902, Grigsby's career spanned 6 decades to the 1960s in statehood. His knack for treading the fine line between what was considered clever and what would be considered dishonest made Grigsby popular and a very successful trial lawyer throughout Alaska. Lawyers came to court to watch Grigsby perform. Afterward, they'd push back a few drinks with the old man of the bar and listen to him spin war stories. Impressions of Grigsby range from brilliant legal strategist to drunken bum, depending on where and when lawyers met him. But all pretty much agree that Grigsby represented, for good or poor, Alaska's frontier lawyer. So the title of the book comes from Grigsby. One of the people I interviewed was Ziegler, and his father had, I just forgot his first name, Bob Ziegler,
yeah.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And his father, A.H., had practiced in Ketchikan in the 1920s. So A.H. Told this story about Grigsby to his son, because A.H. had seen Grigsby in court. And I have to tell you, there were fish traps back then.
Yes.
And fish traps were illegal everywhere else in the country except for Alaska. And people really did not like to convict anybody of robbing a fish trap, which was called fish piracy. So this case that A.H. Ziegler remembered was a case of fish piracy against a notorious fish pirate by the name of Johnny Starkloff. The case rested upon an incriminating hat left at the scene of the crime. And all during the trial, that hat held a prominent position on the prosecutor's table. And it was apparent that the prosecution intended to connect Starkloff to the hat. So at the noon recess, Grigsby went downtown to the local haberdashery and bought a hat of identical style, the biggest damned hat he could find, Ziegler said. And this is what his father had told him. Grigsby got back to the courthouse before everyone else and exchanged hats. when the prosecutor called Starkloff to the stand and asked him whether the hat on the table was his, Starkloff replied he'd never had a hat like that in his life. And the prosecutor confidently asked Starkloff that he'd just try on the hat. And the hat came clear down to his shoulders, and the case was laughed out of court. So that was the biggest damned hat.
So, and it tells a story on Grigsby because he's pretty clever and kind of outside the box in terms of his strategies, right? Mm.
Outside our box, but probably not outside the box of that day. I mean, they did some pretty, yeah.
Pretty wild and crazy things.
Yes. They did.
It was. Mm-hmm.
Well, another one that really struck me was out of Nome, and I wonder if you would tell that story. The three Swedes are well known in Nome because of their gold claims, but there was this rumor in Nome that you couldn't be a non-citizen, I guess, and have your gold claims. And of course, people were getting jealous of them and their gold, and this was really roiling. And surprising things happened to their gold. So.
Yeah. And, you know, and that story is one of those stories that has been told, like, in film. And, I mean, it's just one of those apocryphal stories about Alaska and probably set the stage for people not really wanting to trust the judiciary because the first judge in Nome, Judge Alfred Noyes, got his position because a political boss, had him appointed. And the political boss was Alexander Mackenzie. And Mackenzie had him appointed because he wanted to mine those claims. Of the three Swedes, right. Yeah. So all of their claims were tied up in court to determine whether or not they had the right to mine them because, and actually they weren't all non-citizens. Some of them are citizens, some of them weren't, but didn't make any difference.
They were alien or something like that. Yeah.
That's just saying that they weren't a citizen of the United States.
Okay.
But the law is very clear that you don't have to be a citizen to own land. I mean,
it wasn't a gray area.
No, it was not a gray area. But that was part of, you know, if you have the court and you have the judge and the judge decides that it is a gray area and he wants to wait for a few weeks as he thinks about it and then wait a few more weeks and then wait a few more weeks until the end of the season when you can no longer mine gold, which is exactly what happened. So he had appointed Mackenzie the receiver. The receiver is not supposed to mine it. They're supposed to protect it. But he did mine it. And, you know, millions of dollars of gold went into Mackenzie's pockets. And the lawyers had to appeal to the Ninth Circuit, which is, 1,200 miles away. Takes, you know, you take the ship down, you take the ship up, and there's no mail service. And finally, the marshals had to come and get Mackenzie to stop.
But he still got the money. Didn't they put the money in a trust or something like that? Did the judge arrange something like that where the money was away from the three Swedes and he ended up with some of it? Or
I remember reading what happened was, and I don't know how Noyes got the money, but it talked about him having sacks of gold as he went onto the ship to leave town. So it was never really clear how he got the gold and Mackenzie, where he put his gold. But eventually the Swedes got the money back. I mean, they got their claims back. And George Grigsby's father, who was Melvin O. Grigsby, one of Teddy Roosevelt's companion, Rough Rider, got an appointment as the U.S. attorney in Nome. He actually had some sort of deal with one of these people, too. I mean, it's so small. Everybody knows each other, and there are all these deals, and money is involved.
Because Mackenzie wasn't even in Alaska. He was in North Dakota or something doing all his wheeling and dealing about Alaska, which was, you know.
But he knew what was happening in Alaska, and he actually tried to get the laws changed on a federal level.
Yeah.
So, which didn't happen. I think the country is so small. I mean, we don't have that kind of understanding now of how someone can look and see where they want to make a money. And Alaska was a place where they figured they could do it, and no one was really going to stop
them. No one was watching.
Right. There were no checks and balances. And, of course, I can't help but say, as the chair of the Fair and Impartial Courts Committee, that, you know, the appointment of an unqualified judge for political reasons rather than merit-based reasons is, I think that these historical precedents really did lead at some point when we were forming our Constitution to look back at our history and say, what can we do to stop that in the future? I do think it, you know, at some level, these stories and memories...
At a very high level.
Yeah.
I think absolutely. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that they had something to do with the way our Constitution was formed. So, it was a small state, relatively speaking, but the distances, when one thinks about filing an appeal with the Ninth Circuit, and that would have to be done on a ship with a piece of paper from Nome, you know, to San Francisco, it's a true world away. And
I'm going to just, if you've just joined us and you're wondering, what are they talking about? We're talking about this, The Biggest Damned Hat, which is a book about territorial judges and lawyers in Alaska. I'm here with co-host Elaine Andrews and with the book's author, Pam Kravis. And if you've got questions or you know some of these characters from Alaska's rather short history and want to tell a few stories, we'd welcome it at 550-8433. Or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's see. I'm just thinking about reactions to the book. What kinds of reactions have you gotten? It's out this year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and actually, Elaine had a question about a lot of the research was done in the 80s, but the book came out now. Was that just, that's the way it happens? You know, you finally find time to do the writing?
Sort of. I did it, and I published parts of it along the way, but it wasn't until recently that the UA Press, I'd applied to the UA Press to see if they were interested in publishing, and they were. And I think some of it has to do with the timing, with a lot of the people I interviewed were at really the height of their careers when I talked with them. So people like Roger Cremo and Judge Fitzgerald and... Seaborn Buckaloo. I mean, all of these people. If you think about it, in the 1980s, this was at their, you know, they
peak
were
of their careers.
They are the peak. This is where they were, the people who really were foundational at the statehood time.
Right.
And so, I don't think it was a good time to publish something like this. And now is a much better time where you have a better sense of what the historical framework they were working in. And I'm sort of really grateful that I didn't spend, you know, I waited to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that when you're talking to people, you're too influenced often by them, and they're very strong personalities. And until you have a little bit of time.
Distance.
A little bit of distance, and also where you don't have to feel like you have to be nice. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you can actually try to put it in a context mm-hmm. that you feel has some kind of... cohesiveness and historical context. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what that extra time provided.
Yeah, I can see that. It's fairly chronological, am I right?
It is.
That's
mm-hmm.
it. And certain characters like Grigsby really, really emerge. Others that are names people might recognize, like Nesbitt, Buell Nesbitt, the Nesbitt Courthouse downtown, or who's Boney's first name?
George
Boney. I, for the first time, was learning who those characters were, and they were very significant, especially Nesbitt, right?
I love that you call them characters.
Well,
was the first Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Yeah.
And you know what? That is what I had wanted.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's exactly, I mean, that was like, that's like the perfect, because you get to actually understand them as human beings and not their positions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was, do you know his story, Elaine Nesbitt? It seemed like he was in the throes of the Anchorage court, but then when he became on the Supreme Court, he kind of wanted to tidy things up and then ran into some real stiff opposition. Is that something we could talk about?
Sure.
Go ahead.
It's a legendary story among...
Oh, the court bar fight.
The court bar fight, yes.
Mm-hmm. The court bar fight is... You know, the court bar fight, I was really, really careful about going through all the court records, finding all the people and doing it. So it's... And that one I did a law review article on as well. So I think I can give you the outlines of it.
Sure. I mean, as somebody...
Because there's so many...
I didn't know about it until... I'm sure lawyers maybe know, but I'm not a lawyer, and I didn't know, and I found it fascinating. So tell us about it.
Oh, tell us about it. Okay. Well, it all has to do with disciplining of lawyers. And
who needed some disciplining.
Well, but lawyers don't really enjoy being disciplined.
Right.
And I would say we were talking beforehand about even being asked to wear a suit and tie in court. I mean, really, if you can't have a court tell you what a suit and tie is and comply to that, can you imagine having a court decide whether you can practice law or not based on whether you've broken some rules or didn't do something? And and that's what Nesbitt was trying to do. He didn't think that the Bar Association was doing a good enough job of disciplining attorneys, and so he wanted to make it part of what the Supreme Court would do. And it ended up being a big fight between the bar and the court. And they tried to mediate it because the National Bar Association didn't want to have any precedent setting whether or not Supreme Courts could discipline attorneys or not. And I actually not even quite certain how it's done in other places. But it shook out that the bar continued to discipline its own attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very general.
Right. Yeah. There was some discussion about bar associations being sort of, or the bar itself, I guess, being under the executive branch, whereas here it was independent. So there must be practices elsewhere where the bars are under executive. Don't know? We don't know.
I'm not comfortable enough to have an opinion about the, you know, what's done nationally on that topic. But I think that the colorful story about the bar fight was the incident in the bank.
Yeah, it was.
Oh,
yes.
Right.
And
right.
That was Roger Cremo. And Roger Cremo was, he was wonderful to interview. It was Roger Cremo and Tom Stewart. And so Roger Cremo's with the bank, and he's, you know, what had happened was the Supreme Court had taken over the funds of the bar because they were going to take over the bar. But the court, and so they had to go get the funds. And the funds
from
were
the bank.
From the bank. And Roger Cremo was at the bank, and Tom Stewart was the court administrator. And Tom Stewart is an absolutely wonderful, or was an absolutely wonderful person, and put in a position to deal with an Anchorage bar, which obviously was going to try to manipulate things as well as they could. And so Roger Cremo said, I don't think I can, you know, we can give you this money until we have a show of force, at which point Tom Stewart had a law enforcement officer with him, and the law enforcement officer either drew his gun or put his hand on his gun. But the upshot is it was in the newspaper almost before it actually happened. So the front page of the newspaper. You know, so it's pretty much a manipulation. It's sort of how things were done back then. I mean, you could have contacts at the press. You had contacts everywhere in order to make things happen.
Yeah, wasn't the headline something like, at the point of a gun,
bar court funds taken at gunpoint.
Supreme Court takes bar funds. I mean, you know, very dramatic. So
And like cases often are, they're done in the press. And so this was part of getting the public behind the bar. And of course, the worst thing about this is that Harry Arendt, who is one of the Supreme Court justices, was up for retention during this whole time. And even though it was Beall Nesbitt, the chief judge, who was really the person at the helm of this movement.
Takeover.
Harry Arendt was the one who lost his seat on the bench.
And he was not a complainer, right? He said something like,
right,
you take the heat or something, you know, you take
neither he nor Diamond. I mean, really, Nesbitt was the force in the court. And what ended up happening was the court was expanded. Justice Rabinowitz took Arendt's spot, and then more justices. There was Boney. And so some of the people who had been fighting Nesbitt ended up on the court. And so there was a transition.
It's interesting. So, I mean, that's really we had the Chief Justice on a year ago, Elaine.
Right.
I was looking at our records, and it's like we had the Craig
Stowers
on just a year ago. Yeah. Right. So I
Not
do have respect for the Chief Justice. I do.
Yeah.
But he was still a character. I would say Nesbitt was a character.
Oh, yeah.
So, let me think. I wanted to ask you, or Elaine, jump in if you've got any questions. We were saying to you, oh, Pam, we want to hear some of your favorite stories. And you said, well, the stories aren't my favorite. The people were my favorite. So I'd love to hear a little bit about some of your favorite people.
Yeah. Well, Roger Cremo was one of my favorite, and so was Tom Stewart. But they were never part, you know, they weren't big parts of the book. So it was often like a narrative that I followed. Dorothy Holland ended up being a friend, and she was really remarkable. And I thought about this recently. You know, there are women lawyers that were there at Territorial Times, and one of them was Mildred Herman, who was here in the 1930s and 40s, and people always thought of her as the first woman lawyer. She was a Republican. She would never say she was a feminist. She would always say, you know, she got what she got because she was a smart woman and she could do it. Well, Dorothy Holland was always a feminist, and she always understood what women could not get. And she was one of the few people I interviewed that actually saw that, which was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. A lot of women in the professions, because they were unusual at the time and they were very good, did not think of themselves as second-class citizens and would not have thought of themselves as being discriminated against. Mm-hmm. But Dorothy always had that understanding, and she would say, you know, when the feminist movement came around, whoa, finally, people are catching on.
What was her story? Where did she come from, and did she go to law school, or did she?
She did go to law school in the 1940s, and her sister was a doctor, and she was a lawyer, and
she came from out of state.
She did, and I was just going to turn to Dorothy, and she was at the Constitutional Convention. So she was born in Minnesota in 1918, and she grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And it's kind of funny that I have to go read this because for the longest time, I would always use Dorothy for any stories I was writing. So I worked for Senior Voice for a while. And Dorothy, I think I could write about you for this.
Yeah. So it was, repurposing your material.
It was really fun. Yeah. And she was always game. She was just great. I mean, she's just one of those lively, intellectual sort of people with very firm opinions.
Was she in her 80s when you met her?
No, she wasn't that old. She was in her mid-50s. Okay. Oh, wait, no. If she was 1918, and I talked to her.
I have to do the math.
I know, 60s.
Yeah.
Okay. Like,
yeah.
She's in her 60s. Now, she wasn't that old. Uh-huh. And she was the, you know, her husband, Ragnar, had worked out on the base, and she was the force in her family. It was really interesting.
Why did you click?
He was, too. I shouldn't say that. I mean, he was a
he was
wonderful
doing his
man.
Thing, and she was
and,
doing hers.
And they read together. They were intellectuals. They were just fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So did you immediately click with her, or did you warm to each other, or what was that like? Or did you just admire her so much because of
I admired her. Uh-huh. Admired her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm sort of fascinated that, you know, you come from out of state, you probably under 30. I'm just guessing you went from college to law school. So, you know, do the math. You're 25, 26. You show up in Anchorage. You decide this would be a fun thing to do. I mean, it's such an Alaska story. And so there you are, and you just pick up the phone and say, I want to talk to sort of the most important legal people in the entire state, from people who were at the peak of their careers, you suggest, Judge Fitzgerald, Judge Bucklew. You waltz in and they grant you an interview, and off you go. It's a pretty remarkable, really Alaska-based story.
Were you always well received, easily received?
I was well received. I was always well received, but there were a number of people who were very reserved. So I have to say that Justice Rabinowitz was extremely reserved, and you know, and I much of what I quoted were his oral histories later in his career after the 2000s. So some of this history was, you know, these are people who are very high up and don't want to have things on the record. Fairbanks was difficult.
Am I surprised?
I've heard that before, to say.
Oh, Fairbanks was really funny. Yeah. Juno was not. Juno was a blast. Juno, I mean, everybody had an opinion about everybody else in that
town.
Oh, that's
town. Great.
It was
that's
so
great.
Much fun.
Well,
yeah.
We have to take a little break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk. I gathered from the book there was a real difference in Anchorage's legal climate and Juno's legal climate. So maybe when we come back, we'll pick up there. So you're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm here with co-host and legal expert Elaine Andrews, and we have author Pamela Kravis, who has just published The Biggest Damned Hat, and we've been talking about it. It's really the history of the rough and tumble territorial history of judges and lawyers here, starting kind of in the 1900s, I would say. And just before we broke, I said to Pam, I picked up from the book that people had a real sense of what Juneau was like and that they kind of wanted to move on to Anchorage, so new territory. And so I kind of want to learn a little bit what that was about. We talked the most about those two cities. There's some Ketchikan in there and some Fairbanks. But, you know, I imagine the way I picked up on it is that Juneau was more like the lower 48, a little more formal, a little more staid, some long-term practitioners, wasn't really all that easy to break in maybe, and Anchorage was fresh territory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes. Juneau tried to be like the lower 48, even though they were pretty far away, and the people often didn't have law degrees. I mean, they were practiced in each other's offices. The thing that made Juneau different is it was the center of government and also the center of all commerce. So mm-hmm. they had big clients, and they were very protective of their clients. They did not want other people coming in and taking their clients. So it was pretty much a closed shop. Mm-hmm. And John Helenthal, whose parents, whose father and uncle both practiced in Juneau, were contrary to a lot of other lawyers there, they both had law degrees from the University of Michigan, and they had their own building, and they had a mine, and they, you know, so they had a pretty good practice. But John had no interest in staying there. He really wanted to go somewhere where he could start over, just as you were saying, in that kind of rough and tumble Anchorage.
Didn't he do a little mining in Juneau? And then when he was up in Anchorage, he also did some other labor before. I mean, he was sort of a man of all
the people.
Yeah.
A man of the people.
Yeah. But And then can you tell us a little bit about him as a lawyer? What kind of, was he a colorful, flamboyant lawyer, or did he tend to be the sort of tighter, buttoned-down kind of lawyer?
He was definitely not buttoned-down, but he was also a legislator, and he had the best interests of the territory at heart. I mean, he had a real sense of territorial interests. So, mm-hmm. And I think he was at the Constitutional Convention, too. And his father became a judge in Anchorage. So even though I don't think we could ever call him a staid lawyer.
No, we could not.
Not even close. He had a pedigree, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, though he kind of rejected it, he had.
And I think, you know, it's interesting if you tell folks about how it is that people did become lawyers. I mean, the notion that, you know, that he had a pedigree because he had both family history and a law degree was actually a little bit out of the norm in the early days. Can you kind of shed some light on that?
Sure. That's absolutely right. So take someone like Norman Banfield. So Faulkner Banfield is the oldest firm in our state, and it goes way back to the early 1900s where H.L. Faulkner had been a marshal. He never practiced law. I mean, he never had a law degree. He just practiced in somebody's office and set up and got all these clients, you know, the electric company, all the utilities, gold mines. And he had too much business, and Norman Banfield was up in Juneau at the Depression. He'd come up with the Weather Bureau. And
he was a weatherman.
He was a weatherman, yes. He was, well, a different kind of weatherman than we, right. He was a weatherman. And but his salary wasn't covering his needs, so he could see that there was money to be made in the legal profession. Faulkner needed a partner. They went out and staked mining claims, and they were very compatible. So Norman Banfield just worked in Faulkner's office and basically passed
like
the bar.
Like an apprenticeship, sort of?
Like an apprenticeship, yeah. Passed the bar on Faulkner's save. And Faulkner, you know, had a huge amount of power in huge. You read through the newspapers and you just see how much power he had there.
So he did take the test.
Yes, he took the test.
What does taking the test mean in those days?
That's absolutely right, because who's grading the test? And, I mean, even Banfield said he didn't think he did very well and that they took Faulkner's word for it. So Mildred Herman took the test, too, and didn't pass.
Several times,
mm-hmm, correct. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
Right. Yeah. So there was not truly an objective written test. I mean, there may have been some writings that they had to do, but my recollection is there's kind of a panel of people that looked at the applicant and maybe question them individually and try to determine if they knew enough.
Almost like a job interview, sort of. Yeah.
You know, I don't know back in Banfield's time whether it was written or a panel. I do know that in the 1950s there was this case in Re Herman and Arnett, and it was Russ Herman, who was Mildred Herman's son, and Russ Arnett, who challenged the bar, saying that if you had been in Juneau, you would know what was going to be on the bar. But if you were practicing out like in Nome, where Russ had been, you wouldn't know, and so you'd be at a distinct disadvantage. And they wouldn't know you either.
Hmm. I have a funny personal story about
you're passing the bar?
Well, about not me, but shall we say it's someone close to me who, uh-huh. This was when Alaska did not have its own bar exam, and they used the Oregon bar exam as the bar exam. And so if you lived in a remote part of the state and you couldn't attend the bar review courses and so on and so forth, you would just get, you know, the bar review materials from somebody else. And so my husband got the bar review materials for Oregon and studied those bar review materials and, of course, then had to take a boat or a plane to Juneau to take the test. And at that time, they did allow typing. You could have one room had typers and one room had writers so that the typers were all in the same room. And when you study for the bar, you have these sample questions that you can look at, and then you do the answers, and then you go back to the key and you see, you know, what pieces you missed. So, you know, it's a practice kind of thing that you do to prepare for the bar. And so he opened up his test and saw that they had somehow imported, he must have had an old preparation book, and they put on the Alaska bar one of these old Oregon questions, which he had already worked on and outlined and knew it. And so he said he opened up the test and saw the question, quickly read through it, realized he'd seen that question before. And before anyone could even really finish reading the question, he was
typing away.
He said, you know, people looked at him ready to, you know, throw daggers
shoot
at
him.
Yes.
Yeah.
So even in the late 60s, the things were really quite different.
Let's see. I was still thinking about some of the names that we recognize. I recognize Ed Boyko was a name. I got here in '80, and he was still around. People talked about him. Wendell Kay, I don't think I ever met, but he was another really strong character here. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Wendell Kay was really fun, and that was one of the ones that I'm really glad that there was a lot of time between when I knew, had met Wendell Kay, and when I wrote about Wendell Kay. And it's not that I really changed so much about what I wrote about him, but I understood a little bit about him better, because he was a consummate criminal defense attorney. And, you know, married many times, had many children, had a big drinking problem, but was somebody who was brilliant as a trial attorney. He loved George Grigsby. They were mentors. You know, mm-hmm. So there's this direct line between the frontier lawyer and Wendell Kay. And Wendell would you know, talk about the impact of drinking, you know, that it really did make a difference. And Judge Fitzgerald would tell stories about Wendell having his, as he would say, bacon saved in court when people thought he was drunk. But, you know,
somebody was sent down to the marshal's office
for a sobriety test.
Yep, and he passed.
Somehow. Right. That's exactly right.
Was that Wendell Kay?
That was Wendell Kay.
Okay.
Right. And so Wendell Kay was in Judge McCary's courtroom. And so Judge McCary was the last territorial judge. And he was, as we said before, he'd come up as a salesman for the Utah Woolen Mills in the 40s, went back and got a law degree. And his legal ability was not as good as Wendell Kay, graduate of Northwestern on the Law Review. And so they also had personalities that were very different. I mean, McCary was a very devout Mormon and family man and very well respected in the community as a judge. And Wendell was a hellraiser. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they butted heads in court, and Wendell could do circles around him as far as legal things. But Wendell also could do things like Grigsby and the Damned Hat. You know, somehow a major witness wasn't available, but perhaps he'd been put on a plane and flown somewhere.
Away.
Correct. So he was a lot of fun to talk with. And by the time I talked with him, he had a chair at, I think it was the University of Arizona, and he was well respected in teaching. Mm-hmm. But he had he was definitely a wild man.
Did some of these people care about how you portrayed them? Did they go to invest energy in how you saw them, or were they by that time late in their life kind of very straightforward about things, or were they still trying to leave a legacy of I don't know, just impressive, you know,
respectability.
Yeah. Or just, you know, fireworks, you know, wild and woolly and that kind of thing. Or what did you think? I mean, I every time you interview people, they're giving you their version of the story, and you've acknowledged that that's what you have. But did you feel like they were painting a picture that was embellished?
I felt every single one was painting a picture. I had many pictures to choose from,
yeah,
which is why it was really nice to talk to other people. You know, everybody puts themselves in the best light possible. I mean, that's how you always describe yourself. And the other part is, yes, I was in my 20s, and so I was...
You weren't challenging them.
Correct.
You were taking...
I was like, yes, that sounds
very
right
interesting
to me.
Story. Right. Well, you know, you mentioned before the break that everybody in Juneau was willing to talk about everybody else. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh, I love Norman Banfield. So Norman Banfield had been practicing forever by the time I talked to him. You know, he'd come in 35, and I talked to him in the early 80s. And everybody was interviewing Norman. And so it felt like he was the holder of history about Juneau. And he'd have opinions about every lawyer. Henry Roden was on the public dole. You know, William Paul, you know, Alaska Natives shouldn't go to him. They should go to me instead.
I need the business.
Right. I mean, so he, every single one, you know, he would have an opinion about them. And, you know, he himself had not been to law school. He had partners who, Boot Cheever was on the Ninth Circuit Court. He was a partner. You know, he had, and I liked Banfield because he was just who he was. You know, you knew him. You could see very clearly. He was a really hard worker, mm-hmm. and he pulled himself up. You know, mm-hmm. he learned everything, mm. and he had a great respect for the law and the respect for his clients and respect for the money he made and doing good work for them. You know, it's kind of a work ethic from the 1930s and 40s, mm. and you really heard that ingrained in what he said. So even if I heard all of his prejudices and things that we, you know, today would find like, oh my goodness, I also heard this enormous work ethic and mm. this real care about how his firm represented itself.
Mm. You know, another theme that I picked up, and he was part of it, was some of these territorial lawyers were representing outside interests that were against the territorial interests or against the people that were living and working here. And he was one of them, right? Mm-hmm. I believe he represented fisheries or canning companies. And that, you know, the idea is a lawyer is hired by clients, right, and to do the work. But it must have been interesting, and I don't know if any of them talked about the tug-of-war they might have felt over some of the cases that they had.
I don't think that they had any problems
representing the outside.
No, interests. And I think that, you know, we can look at oil companies now, and you look at the different interests that Alaska always has, and there always are multiple interests. And I think he did the best job possible for his interests. And if you think about the time period that he was in, he was very proud of the fact that he was a lawyer who had these clients. These
he was are the proud top, to have those clients.
Yes, he's proud to have. It's a whole different orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the things about history is that, you know, our orientation where we have feelings about different things, mm-hmm. is our point in time, and their point in time is governed by a whole bunch of other things.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess one of the things that I found really interesting was women lawyers and how we might consider how they looked at their clients as paternalistic. Some of these very old, so I'm thinking Isabel Gilman, who from the turn of the century time, I'd have to look exactly when, but yeah, she was like one of the second.
Truly, I have to say one of the most astounding things that I read in this book, you know, were some of the very earliest women lawyers who I had no idea that they were here, and they were women. One of them was a doctor who then went to law school in her 50s, mm-hmm. and lived in Fairbanks. I mean, extraordinary people at an extraordinary time. But I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
But you were saying it's, you know, they.
What do you mean that they had paternalistic?
Oh, not all of them. So what I was going to say is that this Gilman and who you're talking about was an amazing woman. But I'm not. This is a different person that I know very little about, except that she was also a school principal. And if you and she wrote extensively, and if she wrote about her Alaska Native students, there you read about that point in time, and it's like she's lauding them and saying how wonderful, you know, their achievements are, but the subtext is how unusual this is for this person. So it's so hard when you deal with this to try to figure out how to portray people so that you understand them in the context of their time.
I think that's a great point, because you tend to think your slice of the world is the way it is and has always been.
Or should be.
Or should be, right. And I remember reading about how mining interests were on the in the legislature. And, of course, people have been, you know, vocal about oil interests being in the legislature. But it's an old story. And it's and of course, fisheries interests, you know. So it's not unique, you know. But so history is really worth knowing and really worth reading. So for that, I'm just really grateful. I'm going to throw our numbers out one more time for our listeners. You can give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage, or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. We're just talking about The Biggest Damn Hat, which is a book that Pam Kravis published this year. Interviewed 50 lawyers, read through, I'm sure, voluminous newspaper accounts and also court records on some of those things, like the court bar fight. And it's very colorful and very interesting, and very, very human. The people are so human. Another person we haven't talked about, which I might throw out there, is Grace Strabel,
who was
the first woman attorney general for the state. We now have another, Jana Lindemuth. But tell us a little bit about Grace.
Grace was really wonderful to interview, and she was that epitome of, I'm just a lawyer, and I'm just a really, you know, she grew up in Alaska. She had that pedigree like John Helenthal of being here, knowing everybody. And
Were there lawyers in her family? I don't remember.
No immigrant family, okay. But she was born here, but in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
Such an impressive person, you know, all those firsts that she had.
And she was in Fairbanks. She was in a law firm, and eventually she was one of the lead partners of that law firm.
Right.
Yeah.
She was the first woman to be the lead partner of a multi-partner law firm.
Yeah. What was she?
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, there's so many great stories here. I mean, speaking of first, we had M. Ashley Dickerson, who was the mm-hmm. first black woman admitted to the bar in Alabama, right. And then came here, which is a story, and actually, I meant to ask you before we went on air, but it referred to her three teenage boys. And at some point in my life, someone told me that she had triplets. I didn't know if those were triplet boys.
I think so.
So triplet boys, first woman,
and a single mom.
By the time she got to Alaska, and of course, I absolutely love the story about her in federal court. And
you can tell that story.
It's just I've only heard it told, so
I only heard it told too.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's hearsay, but go ahead and tell us.
Well, she's in federal court, and I have to say, I was of that era when, you know, women were not allowed to wear pantsuits in court because it was considered, you know, not appropriate dress. And so she showed up, I guess, in a pantsuit to try a case. And the federal judge basically said, you know, at the noon recess, you'll go home and you will return in proper court attire. We don't allow pantsuits for women. And so she returned in a ball gown with a tiara. Yeah. She had a dress on, and I think she just, you know,
she wasn't going to take it lightly.
She was going to obey the letter of the order, but certainly not the spirit of it. And she was a feisty gal. She was around for a long time. So, another really interesting woman.
Yeah. Right. I remember, I think we Alaskans had a cover story on her at the Anchorage Daily News later in her career, maybe when she was living out in the valley and maybe wasn't practicing as much. But we've got a caller, and I'm going to welcome Caroline on to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Caroline.
Yes, hi, and I'll try to be brief, but that story just reminded me of the subtlety of success. So, you know, she got there the right way. But history is such a fun thing. And coming into this stuff, sometimes it's as if we look as if the things that happened before we got there don't matter. And I remember the vote to get rid of the income tax, which was in place when I first got to Fairbanks in 67. John Butrovich, who was a senator, Republican senator out of Fairbanks, and Zig Ziglar, Democratic senator out of Ketchikan, best of friends, which was really rare compared to today. No, everybody was friends back then. But anyway, they begged people to not get rid of the income tax because it had taken them decades to get it passed up against the fisheries industry, because they basically ran things in Alaska out of Seattle. But, that and the other thing that reminds me of how the history and how it's good is I heard many years ago that our roads came in many cases from the cart paths, and the cart people taking their wagons were where the animals had gone through, and starting with the first animals that went through and took a particular area in the terrain, you know, this particular path, that in large part proves how we need to look at history and see which way we stumbled and which way we had easy footing. So thank you very much for this. I think it's terrific. Oh, and one more thing about taxes. The old expression, when people pay taxes, they pay attention.
Okay. Thanks, Caroline. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
I can say a little bit about the taxes.
Sure, go ahead.
So in 1948, I think, is when they did pass the taxes. And Caroline, you're absolutely right. It took forever for that to happen. But I think that half the territorial legislature was actually lawyers at the time.
Oh, yeah. That was another point I was thinking about. Out of, I don't know, 30 or maybe 50, 16 of them were lawyers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. They just got involved in everything back then. Uh-huh. They were really civic minded and, pretty much knew their communities pretty well.
Yeah. So I since the Alaska, I'm thinking about the court bar fight. And the discipline of lawyers sits with the bar. Am I right? Is that the way that ended up,
or
is that
yes and no?
Simplistic.
It begins at the bar, but ultimately our Supreme Court determines the appropriateness of the discipline. I mean, ultimately it's the Supreme Court that has the final say.
Right.
So the bar can recommend disbarment, and then the Supreme Court reviews the record and
makes the final decision.
So it's a joint operation, I guess I would say.
And has it worked? Has it worked well?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is we have a very vigorous
judicial council.
It's not judicial council. It really is the bar has we have full time staff of bar discipline lawyers, and then it goes to the board. It's a very vigorous process, and of course, you know, even though the bar is much bigger than it used to be, it is still, relatively speaking, a small town. And so there is a lot of, shall we say, informal curbing of misbehavior before it gets to anything that anyone can complain about because, it's a small community, a legal community, and people recognize that the reputation of any lawyer reflects on all lawyers, and so there's almost an internal desire to keep it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Another thing that comes out in the book is World War II and Anchorage and how bustling it was. I think you had some figures in there of 150,000 troops at one point were at Fort Rich, and, you know, the Alaska Highway was being built. All that, I mean, you know, that just, I would have loved to be here then. I think it would have been a really fabulous time. And to be one of those early lawyers here would have been really fun, too. By the way, Elaine, you said you had perhaps Wendell Kaye before you.
Yes.
At least once, maybe?
Yes, yeah. Yes. But anyways, it would have been towards the end of his his career. But he, you know, even in his dwindling days, he had a presence. He had a strength and a charisma and a very strong presence in the courtroom. And, and usually if he was there was usually one or two people there to watch, at least. I mean, you know, it was when he was practicing, I was a district court judge, so they would have been preliminary and lower matters. But even if he was showing up for that, there, you know, it was always a gab fest before or after wherever he showed up. Let's put it that way.
Another thing that I loved was the floating court, which was in the spring and in the fall. I think it was McCary, was that right, out of Juneau, would go down the chain and they would hold court. And the description there was that after a long winter, people would come to court to watch the drama. I mean, it was, you know, taking you away from that sort of oppressive long winter. And there were these dramas playing out in maybe the school. I don't know where the courtrooms were, but that seemed really kind of cool too. This, and I imagine we still have some. Do we have itinerant judges still?
I was just thinking, you know, we talk about sort of the floating court, and there's the judge and the lawyers, and they're all on the boat. But I mean, if you are, and we do court in rural areas, you get a charter plane and the judge is on the plane and the district attorney's on the plane and the public defender is on the plane and everyone's together and you fly off and maybe you're going to hold court in a school or a community hall or in some other location that is not a court because we don't have a court there. And and everyone goes there and people take their sides and there's arguments and rulings and everyone gets back on the plane and off they go together. It is the reality of modern day justice in Alaska.
Yeah. So things have changed, but not that much.
Not that much.
Right. Something else that was interesting is that the Supreme Court is located in Anchorage and not in Juneau, which at the time that seemed to be sort of significant. That they decided to put it here. Was it a balancing
actually,
power? Or
Nesbitt decided to put it here.
Nesbitt, okay.
Yeah, one man. And actually, I think it was Walter Hodge who had been on the court originally. And when Nesbitt decided it would be in Anchorage, Hodge got off the court and ended up a federal district court judge.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, we are out of time.
We've just scratched the surface.
I know. It's always that way. But boy, how much fun that was just to delve into some of those characters and early Alaska history. So I really want to thank my co-host and legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, for being here and, you know, sharing stories and some observations. And Pam Kravitz, a lawyer and writer who authored The Biggest Damned Hat, and of course our callers and listeners. The January 17 edition of Justice Alaska will feature a community wellness court in Kenai. Two judges, Kenai Superior Court Judge Anna Moran and Kenaitse Indian Tribe Chief Judge Kimberly Sweet, will be here to discuss this unique joint jurisdiction court. Hometown Alaska will not air next week, but I will return as your host on January 3rd when we feature a discussion on cybersecurity and how to protect yourself or small business from computer hacking. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Justice Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.